I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome back to It's Your Health, where you will learn about today's health issues and get some practical advice to better your life. Joining us today is Michael John Carley, the author of Asperger's from the Inside Out. As the executive director of GRASP, the largest organization comprised of adults on the autism spectrum, he has spoken at conferences, hospitals, universities, and healthcare organizations. He has appeared in the media widely, most notably the New York Times, Washington Post, New York Newsday, London Times, and more. He was featured in the documentary On the Spectrum and in the soon-to-be-released documentary Neurotypical, the movie. Michael John, welcome to It's Your Health.
Lisa, it's my pleasure to be on your show.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you here. Now, after the foreword in your wonderful book, Asperger's from the Inside Out, you write, "Don't judge someone by the cards they're dealt. Judge them by how well they play the cards they're dealt." And what was interesting to me about that is that you were dealt cards without knowing until you were an adult the full extent to what you were actually dealt. And
Right. If
you can tell us first, what is Asperger's for people who aren't sure, and then tell us the story of what led you to getting diagnosed with it.
Sure. Well, Asperger's syndrome, first off, is what most folks consider to be a milder form of autism with no real line that you can really draw in the sand between autism and Asperger's syndrome. It's just a very gradual, very, very complicated morphing of these things. It's usually highlighted by things, you know, like big picture items such as the inability maybe to believe that somebody else might be thinking differently from what you're thinking. And sometimes there are motor skills issues and eye contact issues and just an inability to read also what's referred to as nonverbal communications. You know, if somebody is sort of giving you a facial gesture that you've been talking too long, but you don't really pick that up because you need them to say to you, "You've been talking too long."
I usually need people to say that to me.
Well, and as you alluded to, yes, I got my start in this a little late, and I was one of those many, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people who were just thought of as quirky or failures or eccentrics or spazzes or geniuses as they grew up without really knowing what was going on and what made them, you know, a little different from the rest of the world. And it was only until my then 4-year-old son, well, actually, he was 2 when we first started to figure out that something was going on. And he would do a lot of the same telltale signs that a lot of your parent listeners probably have recognized of a lot of separating toys to be determined by piles of shape and color rather than actually playing with them. There were speech issues, there were hearing tests and play therapy, and then, you know, along comes this word Asperger syndrome that gets thrown in our direction. And one thing led to another, and he and I literally were diagnosed a week apart when he was 4 years old and I was 36 years old in late 2000. And this is no strange occurrence, really. Because of the genetic nature of all of this stuff, usually they're going to look at dear old daddy out of the corner of their eyes when they're looking at a child, and in this case, it turned out to be a match. But he definitely had the big picture sense, or at least I did growing up, that something was decidedly different about you, and you felt different. And this is something that you somewhat struggle with and try to process in the wake of, you know, so much ignorance, because you're surrounded by people that you really love and that you know love you, and yet there's something inside you telling you that you have no real sense of shared experience with them. But you brush that thought aside because we don't want to think of life like that, you know? I mean, we love these people. Nah, it can't be true. You know, of course I've got shared experience with these people because I love them. And yet all these strange happenings, communication gaps, and, you know, sometimes comic and sometimes tragic misunderstandings are happening between you and the rest of the world. So the evidence is always, always there that something is decidedly different here. Mm-hmm. However, and I apologize, I know there's a garbage truck outside the window. In a minute,
please.
I'm like, just so close it, so I apologize.
Oh, don't worry about it.
So, you know in the back of your mind that something's up. You just don't, you're a little scared of that fact because you don't know if it's going to be a positive or a negative. And you only really feel that in absolute full force on the day in which, at 36 years old, somebody tells you, no, you were right to think that you were very, very different. You were right to assume that you were processing things like thought and experience decidedly differently than the people that you love and that loved you.
Wow. That must be really validating. You know, I mean, to go through your life and feeling different and then finding out, it really was. My experience really is different. And in the book, you write something that, now my daughter has Asperger's and she's 5, and you write something that totally reminds me of her. You say, simply the best description of AS I've ever heard came from a 5-year-old boy. And you say, young Dylan Braxton Hamilton was getting examined by his pediatrician. The two had a very good rapport with one another. He could tease Dylan a little, and it was okay. So he half-jokingly told Dylan, I know what's going on with you. You've just got too many wires. And Dylan said, no, doctor, my problem is that the wires aren't insulated well enough. And yeah. I mean, my daughter has absolutely no insulation on her wires whatsoever. And so I just thought of that. And I could imagine her saying that as well.
Yep.
So I feel like knowing that and being able to say to my daughter, yeah, there is something going on and we're here and we love you. And that makes a big difference. That must be nice with your son as well.
It's very nice. And it's especially particularly poignant for me to be able to see the difference between the age in which he's growing up and the age in which I grew up. And, you know, he's going to have, you know, challenges that are, you know, incomparable to mine. But the difference of having a kid that knows what he's got,
oh yeah,
you know, and doesn't feel, you know, this negative iconography surrounding his behavioral differences as he, you know, goes to school, comes home, blah, blah, blah. Having teachers that when he blurts out the first thing in his mouth that other people would interpret to be really rude, perhaps, they understand that while it may be a behavior that needs to be corrected, that his intention was not to be rude. And therefore, that elicits a very, very different reaction than teachers. So in that context, to me, it's fascinating to watch somebody that, in a lot of ways, is my double, growing up in a context that is so vastly different from what I experienced. And it really does teach you that, you know, yeah, we may take a step backwards every once in a while, but there are those two steps forward and that life is progressing very, very nicely. And actually, if I may, I'd like to stand that because, you know, that example that you brought up, which is so wonderful, of Dylan Braxton Hamilton, that really alludes to a huge big picture goal for all of us. And I'm sort of maybe jumping the gun. This is a real, you know, end of interview, you know, sort of observation.
That's okay.
But, you know, I'm petrified of forgetting things. I get them out. One of the things we realize as we run the adult support groups that GRASP runs and sees, you know, more adults than anybody else on the planet is, gee, wonder what life would be like if these adults didn't have those miserable histories and the miserable resumes of all those social banana peels and hurting other people's feelings without meaning to and getting yelled at and testing off the charts but getting fired from the job because you don't understand how to behave at a water cooler conversation. You know, all these things, we separate and we learn to separate the actual diagnosis from the anxiety and the anger and the non-chronic depression that come from all of these bad experiences. And we think to ourselves, boy, what would life be like if that Asperger child didn't have all those negative experiences growing up and they ended up somebody who didn't have the same type of anxiety, anger, or non-chronic depression? They physically, visibly, would look like a completely different icon of what we consider to be Asperger syndrome today. That is going to be a decidedly different human being.
Have you seen people be able to let that go somewhat once they get diagnosed and work through some of these issues?
Yeah, I have. I mean, you know, they're unfortunately, you know, the minority, not the majority.
Yeah.
But if somebody has been raised to think positively about themselves as opposed to negatively, then, yeah, they've got a shot.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody has been, you know, no matter who you are, whether it's, you know, we're talking about your neurological makeup, your sexual orientation, your economic background, your race, your religion, you know, whatever we're talking about that comprises a human being here, quality of support to me is the most important one of all of them. Again, the idea of, are you being raised to think positively about yourself or negatively about yourself? Because those that are brought up to think negatively about themselves, might as well write them off right now. It's just going to be so much more of a struggle to be whatever your, you know, definition of a success is when they get older. And yet the person who is, you know, raised to say, hey, you're pretty good at a couple of things. Hey, you know, we think you're a really good person. And we really love you. And we love you for who you are. That's the person that, you know, is going to have a better chance.
Yeah,
and it's funny we mentioned this today because, you know, we're still enduring so many negative publicity campaigns that crop up every once in a while that just, you know, make an adult with autism or Asperger's that can read what's being written about them and hear what's being said about them just feel terrible about who they are.
Tell us about some of those campaigns.
Well, the most recent one was I think the last straw for a lot of us that Autism Speaks put out, and it was a takeoff on the I Am Africa campaign called I Am Autism, and it was a little bit less than 4-minute video that ends on, you know, a perfectly acceptable celebration of parents, although it still painted the diagnosis as something that needed to be eradicated and quote-unquote fought rather than accommodated and accepted and provided services for. But it's the opening of the video, the first half, which just one of the most offensive things I've ever seen. I don't know how to even, you know, bring this up. You open with Zoom music, you know, just like one of those chords with about 20 cellos hitting a minor key triad and holding it for a long time. And they show photos of, you know, what they would consider probably to be awkward-looking human beings.
Oh, jeez. That's terrible.
Oh, I haven't even gotten to the worst part. And the narration comes over and says, I am autism. If you are married, I will wreck your marriage. I will bankrupt you and take all of your money. And it goes on.
Oh, my God.
Mind-boggling. Our subscribers, our board is still wrestling on how hard to hit that. So grass subscribers out there, we'll see our response fairly well, so long as, you know, we can, you know, whatever agreement we come to as to what this final blast from us on Autism Speaks will look like. But it'll be in the mail soon, folks.
Okay. So obviously that sounds like there's a lot of different ways that people approach education and what's necessary. And like you were saying, it shouldn't be about eradicating. It should be about providing, I think, support and education, like you were saying.
Absolutely. I mean, not only because we've got two different types of arguments here. So we've got a medical argument, and we've got an ethical argument as well. And, you know, the medical side refers to this word cure that, you know, some of us object to and some of us, you know, unfortunately still use. And the sane world really believes this is something that, you know, you got from mom or dad. It may be that mom or dad were just carrier pigeons of the gene, and a total roll of the dice as to, you know, how much of this, you know, quote-unquote autism juice you're going to end up with. But it's pretty much thought that, you know, you got this passed on to you through mom or dad. So anything genetic isn't going to go away. You're born with it and you're going to die with it. But life can improve dramatically, you know, given, again, those right supports and right education and right educate, you know, and, you know, a correct educational strategy. And yet, I think that other people like to put forth as though, you know, there's some competition of suffering. You know, the autism spectrum is so complicated. If you've got, you know, somebody on one side that has to wear adult diapers and a head restraining device and live in a home somewhere and never have a job or an intimate relationship in their life, and yet you've got other people on the other end of the spectrum, such as Albert Einstein, Thomas Edison, and Emily Dickinson, and all these luminaries that are being diagnosed now in retrospect of having asked, that's really confusing for, you know, the average American to be able to swallow. Because you've got, you know, one side that desperately needs services, and maybe one side that desperately needs to get rid of them. You know, but unfortunately, it really is that complicated.
Yeah, you know, I think about my little girl who, you know, and this is actually a question that one of my listeners had is about, you know, kids with Asperger's speaking early.
Part of the diagnostic criteria, you know, that if they spoke early, it's Asperger's. If they spoke late, you know, sometimes they'll diagnose autism, okay. Especially in an early diagnosis. So, yeah, it is fairly common.
Okay.
It's not, you know, an automatic bullet point. Says, well, if this is happening, it's Asperger's syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not an automatic bullet point that if it's not happening, that your child doesn't have Asperger's.
Yeah.
My son, for instance, you know, he spoke a little bit late. And so in a lot of books, you know, people might give him, you know, the diagnosis of autism. But this is a kid that plays guitar that, you know, is, you know, the stud pitcher on his, you know, travel baseball team. And, you know, while he's going through a few teenage issues here, you know, I think that the lexicon of how we look at these words, Asperger's and autism, would place him in the Asperger's syndrome quality. It's so confusing, Lisa, because not one of those bullet points is an automatic you've got it.
Yeah.
And the absence of one of those isn't an automatic you don't have it. It's some happy, weird combination that clinicians, of which I am not, you know, get to wave the magic wand and say, bing, you've got a diagnosis.
Yeah, that's true. Now, actually, that question I wanted to say was from Jennifer from Ontario. And Cindy from Wisconsin actually says that her son was, they believe her son has it, and he was speech delayed. So you were just saying that it can go either way. So I just wanted to emphasize that. Yeah, and there was a lot of things, too, with my daughter that were really like, oh, yeah, that's it. And then there's other things that were like, oh, that's not at all. And one of them is I don't know if it's a myth, but that people with Asperger's, they lack sympathy or empathy. I mean, she's like, you just look sad and she'll be like, what's wrong? What are you thinking? I mean, she's like really into your emotions and very sensitive to that. What do you think about that?
Well, there is truth to that. And, you know, it's part of the diagnostic criteria, but it's also been set up by a misperception about how we view the word empathy. Empathy, unfortunately, is not the same as sympathy, which I think a lot of us don't realize, including me, before I, you know, got into this world. I thought it was pretty much the same thing. Empathy is actually the ability to know what's going on inside the mind of another person. So it's theory of mind. And people with Asperger's, you know, it's not a constant leitmotif amongst everybody with Asperger's syndrome, but there is usually a preponderance of problem in understanding what another person might be thinking as being different from what you have. So it's actually more true than not that people with Asperger's do have difficulty with empathy. But unfortunately, this registers to the American public as that we have difficulty with sympathy and with feeling, you know, with having feelings for other people. Those feelings may come out differently. But people with Asperger's syndrome generally do have feelings for other people, and sometimes very, very strong ones. I think that, you know, one of the things that the behavioral differences present as a real sort of, you know, if you look at things like humor, you have a dual layer of duplicity in terms of the sense of humor of a person with Asperger's versus the sense of humor of somebody else. And that is that, number one, another person might not see that Asperger's sense of humor because something different might trigger it. That person with Asperger's might find something funny that nobody else would think of as funny.
Yeah.
But something different triggers it. And then it gets displayed differently after it has been felt. And because of that different display, then that too might confuse the world.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the more challenged an individual, you know, as we move into, you know, more difficult areas of the spectrum, you sometimes can also get another confusing thing thrown in, which is where you might see a delayed reaction to somebody reacting to something like, let's say, something traumatic happened. Somebody autistic was at home and his parents just had an unbelievable blowout fight and something really awful happened at the end of that fight. Well, there just may be that sense of shock amongst that individual where they just, it doesn't even register to them until a week and a half later and they're sitting in a classroom. And then suddenly it hits them how nasty and how awful that experience was, and then they react, just like they would if they were at home and the incident had just happened for somebody else. You know, you talk to teachers that deal with a lot of kids on the spectrum, they say they have, this happens all the time, where suddenly the child is just reacting to something and their immediate instinct is to look for something that happened right before the reaction, and they can't find anything.
God, the time is going by so fast. You are so fantastic. There was something I wanted to get to about you when you were a child, that they actually did some sort of corrective eye surgery because of your not making eye contact. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that I'm having John Elder Robison on next month. Look Me in the Eye.
Oh, cool.
Oh my gosh, that book! It's a wonderful book. I encourage everyone to read it. But it's so hard, you know, just, oh, you must be a criminal, you're untrustworthy. I mean, did you get some of that growing up as well, because you weren't able to look people in the eye?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was at times. I think,
yeah,
I had, you know, better luck at it than John did, but I mean, I just recently had to do jury duty a couple of years ago, okay, and this is, you know, I'm the Asperger professional now, and I know all this stuff, and, you know, I've just finished my book, and yada, yada, yada. And I realized that, you know, I had to sit and listen to the prosecutors ask potential jurors questions whether or not, you know, they thought that they would make good jurors. The first question that the prosecuting attorney would ask every potential juror was, how could you tell if somebody was lying on the stand? And the first answer out of everybody's mouth, if they couldn't look you in the eye.
Oh, my gosh.
So we have far to go.
Yeah, that's true.
Far to go.
That is true. And like I said, they actually did a procedure, a surgical procedure on you as a child?
They did. They had, I think it was congenital nystagmus was the, you know, the missed call as to what was happening. It was just, you know, lots of teachers screaming at me, you know, look at me when I'm talking to you, Carly, and I'm screaming in peripheral vision, I am, you know. And everybody's all confused. And so they misread it as this congenital nystagmus. And yeah, they put me under the knife. And I had, I think, a week or so of being blind, you know, after the operation and recovery, you know, while my eyes, you know, the sewing up part of it all healed and stuff like that. And then afterwards, you know, it looks like the surgery didn't do very much. And, you know, in a comic tragic sort of way, I got blamed for the operation's ineffectiveness because I hadn't done my exercises enough.
I was going to bring that up. I can't believe they blamed you for it not working out. Actually, I can't.
Well,
people are pretty, you know.
Yeah, you can't believe it, though, because nobody knew any better then.
That's true. I know. You're right.
And that's one of the things that we have to process when we look back on all these horrible things that happened to so many people. Is that, you know, this whole notion and this whole instinct of finding somebody to blame gets us in so much trouble.
That's true.
You know, there's a great Chinese proverb that says that, you know, he who seeks revenge digs two graves. I have a reputation as being, you know, a real battle axe sometimes, but the whole concept of, you know, that we have to find somebody to blame, when nobody knew any better. Nobody knew any better. All you got to keep saying to yourself is nobody knew. And the other thing, Lisa, too, is that incident, that was what made me a music student. You know, I had one of those sensory reactions where suddenly the other, you know, senses go through the roof. I could smell my dog coming up the stairs. I could hear my mother talking in the kitchen downstairs. My old Beatles records suddenly weren't, you know, one homogenated mush of sound. I could now pick out you know, the melody, the harmony. I could hear the bass line. I could, you know, pick out the, you know, what Ringo was doing on the drums. Rainstorms outside my window were suddenly like an orchestra. I became a music student then and there. So that was a heavenly period for me in a lot of ways. And I didn't have to go to school for a week and a half.
Well, how can people find out more about GRASP? And just if you could just tell us real quickly what it stands for.
Sure. GRASP stands for the Global and Regional Asperger Syndrome Partnership. And it is the largest organization in the world of adults who themselves are diagnosed along the autism spectrum. Our executive director, our 50% of our board of directors, and our 100% of our advisory board, as per our bylaws, must be diagnosed along the autism spectrum. We have about, I would say, close to 20, if not 20, regional support group networks that are run by people on the spectrum throughout the country. And you can go to subscribe to any of these groups. You can subscribe to a families and clinicians group if you're a parent. And we have months of free reading on our articles and interviews page. And subscribing is a no-brainer to GRASP because it's free. You just hit the subscribe button at grasp.org, which is there at the top. And you fill out the form and you select which group you want to be. Now, if you're a parent, don't select any of the regional groups like Manhattan or Philadelphia or Albuquerque or Los Angeles or anything like that, because those are for adults on the spectrum. What you should be selecting is the families and clinicians group.
All right. Well, Michael John, I want to thank you so much, and I want to have you back in a few months because I want to talk about how you know, the diagnosis process, your school experience, your baseball experience. We have a lot more to talk about. So everybody, keep tuning in. Now, on Thursday, I'm going to have Dr. Furnett and Brock Eid, authors of The Mislabeled Child. They have a national referral practice specializing in neurolearning, and they are strong advocates for neurologically based approaches to learning and learning differences. And they also specialize in gifted children with special needs. And everyone remember, the entire month of October is devoted with children with special needs. And so be sure to listen. Also on Thursday, Mary Sue Williams and Sherry Schellenberger are OTs, the creator of the ALERT program. They're going to be talking about an upcoming conference in Massachusetts, October 16th and 17th. So be sure to tune in. Have a great week. Keep being healthy. Bye-bye.